For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
All right, good evening.
Good evening.
You know, usually I sort of alternate Dharma talks between some topic from traditional Zen text, especially koans, and then talking about Zazen. So I'm not talking about a Zen text tonight. I'm not sure it's entirely about Zazen. It's a little squishier and sort of non-Zen-y than most talks I've given, I think. But I think on the website it says that the topic for discussion would be practicing with painful emotions, something like that. And I think that's fair. This came up because this Thursday I'm traveling to New Hampshire to visit really one of my oldest and best friends and a real inspiration to me. Bob was my Spanish professor of mine, who I met the spring of my freshman year completing my language requirement. After many years of studying Spanish in public schools, I got to college and placed into... I skipped Spanish 1, but that was about it. So, so I got into Spanish 3 with Bob in the spring and really took off. I was really inspired by his teaching, and so I was allowed to go on foreign study the next fall in Salamanca, Spain, and that's when I got to know him and really we became friends. I wasn't just a student. I became his friend. He was a really inspirational teacher. When we were first arrived in Spain for foreign study, we flew to Madrid to take a train to go to Salamanca. But the first night in Madrid, he took us for a walk through central Madrid, old Madrid, to sort of a tour of the sites in the novels of Benito Pérez Galdós. And Galdós was sort of like the Dickens, the Spanish Dickens, I think it would be fair. Although I think he's certainly as good as Dickens. I won't say he's better, but he's as good as Dickens, and there's a lot in common. He has, you know, the same way Dickens sort of evokes London, Galdós evokes Madrid, and all these really interesting characters, really unusual people. And he was very good at... He's not only a really fine scholar, but he's a brilliant teacher and a brilliant reader and a fine mimic. It was really inspirational to be in a class and have him read from a novel, read a poem. He could do voices very well, and his face could transform if he was reading on behalf of different characters. So we went all through central Madrid, and we went into the Plaza Mayor, the central plaza of Madrid, which is a big square, and it's surrounded on all sides. It's built up. I'm not sure how many stories it is. It could be 10 stories. It may be more than that. But as we would go around, he would say, okay, well, you've read Fortunata y Jacinta, which is Galdós's best novel, undoubtedly. And he'd say, you know, well, right over there, remember, that's where that happened. Then right over there, that's where that happened. And he'd get more and more excited, and we'd get more and more excited. So he got to the Plaza Mayor, and he looks and points at this corner way up at the top, and he says, you see that window? That's where Fortunata's room was. And that is, in the novels that's described, that's exactly where she lived. And that got one of my classmates so excited that she disappeared. And what she had done was to run to find the stairs, because there was no elevator. And she ran up, whatever it was, 10 or 12 stories, and is knocking on the door of this place. And this lady opens the door and hears this strange girl who's clearly American and then starts speaking with this Cuban accent. Saying, did you know that Fortunata lived here? And this lady, you know, clearly is just, what are you talking about? But we, a lot of people got excited when Bob was teaching. And during all the time that he was chairman of the Spanish department at Dartmouth, every year the enrollments in Spanish and the number of Spanish majors increased at a time when throughout the rest of the country, people taking languages was decreasing at all times. And he had generation after generation after generation of people who graduated and went on to graduate school and went on to teach in schools and universities all over the country, teaching Spanish literature. You know, he was inspirational enough as a teacher that when he retired, which is, I don't know, 20 years ago now, people flew in from all over the country to celebrate his retirement. And about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a big celebration of 50 years of foreign study at Dartmouth College, which was for all the programs of foreign study at Dartmouth. But it really just got mobbed by all these people who flew in from all over the country again, and it really became a celebration of the life and career of Bob again. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of bad to just kind of take it over, and people were invited to stand up and talk about how great their foreign language study was and that sort of thing. And it got up one person after another getting up to talk about how great foreign study with Bob was and how inspirational it had been and how it changed their life. And he really was not just a very inspirational teacher. He has always been a very dedicated Christian in the United Church of Christ. And in that vein, has always had the belief, as the United Church of Christ does, that the love of God is expressed through work for social justice. And so he and his wife, who is also a wonderful woman, spent enormous amounts of time volunteering on political issues, social justice campaigns, working in their church, helping to shape policy both at the I was never a member of the United Church of Christ, so I don't remember the different groups, but at the New England conventions and then nationally helping shape church policy. So there were plenty of other people at the United Church of Christ, but they very much were involved in getting the church to support boycott in South Africa, same-sex unions, things like that. So, a lot of us have always thought that Bob was a great guy. I had more of a special relationship with him because, I was in school, I had no money whatsoever, couldn't travel home for holidays and that sort of thing. So they were always big on saying, well, okay, come over and you can stay with us, have Thanksgiving dinner, you can stay with us for Christmas, you can stay with us for the summer because you can't go home for the summer holiday. They would invite me to do house sitting and dog sitting for them when they were on foreign study. And they were very kind because I certainly was an unusual young man. Just barely touching the ground, really kind of spaced out. I was really in love with studying and reading, barely here. And so they sort of helped me stay grounded and watched over me. I'm not trying to say they were otherworldly or saintly or anything like that. I mean, one of my great memories of being with Bob and his wife June was we were in Maine, I think at Bar Harbor or something like that, when Star Wars came out, and we browbeat June, his wife, into going to Star Wars, which Bob and I loved tremendously. So it was like he had these rarefied literary tastes, and that was it. He was not an intellectual snob at all. But, you know, I mean, Bob and his wife June really became almost like family for me. So I've been planning to go visit Bob, and which I've done for as often as I can over the years, and spoke to him a couple of weeks ago just to remind him I was coming. And he let me know, well, I've had some tests, and so I've got this melanoma, and it's spread to my liver, it's spread to my brain, and I'm not going to pursue any treatment for this. So he's 88 years old. His wife died 2 years ago. He's had Parkinson's disease for the last 3 years, so hasn't been able to get around. And also, the Parkinson's has really messed up his eyes, so it's almost impossible to read, which is hard to imagine for somebody whose life has been reading. So, you know, you can imagine. Everybody's been through that. Just an incredible blow. And I'd have to say, excuse me, that I guess you'd have to say I've gone through sort of preliminary grief and mourning. And so, you know, everybody has experienced either grief like that or some other very painful emotion, powerful emotion. If not grief, then some sort of loneliness or fear. You've lost your job. Think you're going to lose your job. Am I ever going to have another job? Are they going to fire me? Significant other has not been faithful. This consuming anger that people can feel. All of that, you know, all of that really painful emotion that can just consume us. We just get caught up in that emotion, completely absorbed. It's almost like, you know, almost like you've been physically hurt. I mean, we just clench up and sort of get caught up in those feelings, the physical feelings, and it just consumes us, and we go over and over and over those feelings, really dwelling on them. And just that experience in itself is very uncomfortable. You know, I mean, emotion is really thinking that evokes physical sensation, and those, you know, loneliness and anger and grief and plenty of others have those really strong physical sensations. You know, your breathing gets messed up. You're all clenched up. I don't know. For me, there's this sort of, I don't know what it is. It's sort of a thrilling sensation that goes through the chest. Mm. Very unpleasant. And I think you know, in addition to just being caught up in it, you know, the tendency is for people to either try to suppress those kinds of feelings or to express them. You know, you either suppress them by trying to just tamp it down altogether, where you just feel kind of dead, or you try to find some way to ignore it, which tends to be, well, I'm going to go out and hang out with my friends, have a good time, I'll watch TV, I'll read a book, have a couple of beers. Or frequently, I mean, we're not really thinking about it, right? I mean, we just, something pushes your button at the wrong time, and you know, your reaction is to try to express it as sort of an explosive, cathartic, completely inappropriate expression that may seem unrelated. You know, you're feeling grief, but you're feeling hurt, so the wrong button gets pushed, and you can respond with anger or whatever. And I wish I could say that Zen practice will keep you from ever feeling that way. But that's just not going to happen. And I don't think I can promise you that when that happens, when that bad thing happens that, you know, Zen practice is going to make you feel calm and it's really all okay. I don't mind. Too bad Bob's going to die. That's not how that works. But even so, it's been my experience, not just with grief when people are going to die or have died, but and other bad things have happened, that Zazen is a huge help. Really, really transformative. You know, you use the Zen mind trick, you know, you sit down, you have good posture, you don't move, you make sure your breathing is normal and relaxed. And you stew and you stew and you stew. There's no question about that. You get caught up in the emotion. But the way in is really to sit there and you know, just like ordinarily, the thoughts come and go, but frequently when you have these painful emotions, there's no real... I mean, there will be times when you're sort of daydreaming, oh my God, this horrible thing could happen. Oh, I'm going to lose my job. Oh, I lost my job. And sort of imagining what that's like or going to be like or how it happened. But lots of times it's not. I mean, there's not any particular thought going on to let go and drift through your mind like clouds. What there is that horrible sensation in your chest and that clenching and the breathing. And that's sort of the way in, is sitting there with your good posture and trying to just relax into your breathing normally and being awake to those sensations. You know, those are sort of physical thinking, physical thoughts. Let them, feel them, be aware of them, let them come, let them go. And if you're lucky, that, you know, being aware of them, but not caught up in them, they become less substantial and they may very well go away, at least for the time being. But certainly, sitting and with the good posture and breathing, there will be moments of clarity when you can wake up and instead of living angrily, maybe you are aware of your anger. So you're anger, but you're not, it's not that you're sitting there and anger is what's dominating you and driving you and shaping everything. You know, when you were caught up in those emotions of anger or grief or loneliness or whatever, it's not just painful, it's you just, your whole way of being and living becomes very narrow. When we sit and we have that gap and it stops for a minute, we can recognize it. There we are, okay, yep, I feel this. There's a sense of spaciousness, and you certainly, you know, grief, you still feel sadness, but you feel sadness, you can relate to the sadness, you can deal with the sadness, but that's not all there is. And that same experience, you take off the cushion with you. So, across the day, we always have those moments of waking up over the day. You may be having a horrible day. You may be walking around with that grief or anger stewing away, but there will come those moments during the day when you go, ah, okay, yes, I'm here, where you can recognize that. You've let go. I don't think you can intentionally let go of anything, but you let go somehow. And then you can carry on. And a more skillful, intelligent way, actually dealing with whatever that emotion is and carrying on with your life. So that in spite of being consumed by it, it's been by the fact of your having waked up and recognized what's going on, you've sort of reframed it. And in spite of being sad or angry or lonely, whatever, you can still, you've experienced a moment of freedom and you're able to act way you would want that. When you're no longer completely shut in, it's no longer all about you and your pain. Mm-hmm. You've opened up and are able to be grateful for someone's life, to be kind to other people, to be generous in your life, which are the expression of our freedom. And in those two things, the ability to wake up, settle with our painful emotions, and act with kindness, friendliness, compassion, gratitude. You know, we settle down and we experience freedom. We open to others. And that's the value that I continue to find in Zen in those most challenging situations. And that's it continues to be an inspiration for me for this very simple practice, this very simple mind trick, the magic of sitting still, not moving, sitting, breathing in a regular way with your eyes open, waking up and engaging with the world and with others in this way that is not caught up in pain and suffering. So I'm going to leave it there and see if anybody has anything to say about a similar experience, or if anybody wants to ask a question or talk, that's great.
That was a really lovely talk, very moving. And I'm very sorry to hear about your friend. As you were speaking, I was reminded of part in Zen My Beginner's Mind where Suzuki Roshi talks about a parent with a very, very sick child and, you know, just being caught up in the anxiety, the fear, the grief of that. And he says, you know, until you have done until you have done zazen in that sort of situation, you're not a Zen student. And I wondered what he meant by that, but I think that part of it is that that's really where, you know, it's in those times where, you know, the practice kind of comes out of all, you know, you talked about as you not having your feet on the ground, and you know, I think there's a tendency a little bit in Zen practice sometimes too, to, you know, we have all these thoughts and talk about this and that. But it's that time when, you know, you're really at this, as you say, this clenched up, knotted up place that the practice and the power of practice really manifests itself. And I just use the word power. You know, Suzuki Roshi, I think in that same passage, he says, you know, at that time, when you sit under these circumstances, I may be twisting this up or compounding two different passages, but I think it's the same one. He says you have a great power. But I think the way you said it is maybe even better, where when you do that, then you can still manifest and express kindness and concern and friendliness. You know, that's an expression of freedom of a kind. And I never thought of it that way. That's beautiful. It's really beautiful. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, I've always linked those two statements myself. That power is to the power to sit and with and face our own suffering. Because that's absolutely not what our tendency is. Our tendency is to somehow get away from that. And the idea that we're going to sit and intentionally be aware of feeling horrible is counterintuitive. But it is healing. to do it. I've found. Will.
I just want to thank you, Douglas, for the wonderful talk. I'm currently taking a class right now on death and dying, and one of our assignments was to interview someone about grief, and I chose to interview both my parents because I was curious to see how they would experience grief differently. And as I began to talk to them, I realized just what a tremendously sort of heavy and deep topic I was getting into, and was also just blown away by the end at how pervasive and deep and complicated grief is. So I just want to thank you for talking about this topic, because I know it's not easy. So.
Well, good. Then we're done, it looks like. We can have announcements and tea.